I'm joined by Anthony Giacchino. He is a documentary filmmaker, and since 1996, is that right?
That's correct.
Since 1996, he's been working on a documentary called The Camden 28. Is that going to be the title,
That's
or are you going to expand?
Camden 28.
Camden 28. Yep. Camden 28 was part of I'm going to let Anthony talk about this because he can do so in a far better manner than the way I'm superficially discussing it now, but... Camden 28 was part of a wave of, I guess, efforts where people on the so-called Catholic left, I guess is the term used to describe this wave of anti-Vietnam protest, actually managed to break into draft boards, selective service boards, and destroy draft documents. As sort of a symbolic way of expressing protest against the war. And Anthony has made a documentary specifically about an episode that occurred in Camden, because I think ultimately the legal resolution was a major turning point for the anti-Vietnam movement. I believe it was the first wholesale acquittal of all the people who were being prosecuted. They were, as you can probably imagine just from my little summary here, they were caught, and they were later acquitted. And we're going to talk about we're going to talk about the trial. We're going to talk about, we have actually one of the participants, also one of the Camden 28 here. He's going to also be sharing some insights now as well. But first we're going to just do a little summary of that. Let me make sure the participant is on the line and can hear us. His name is John Swinglish. John, can you hear us?
Yes, I can, Merlin.
Excellent. All right. I'm going to let you two summarize it far better than that blathery summary I just made. Anthony, why don't you first summarize what happened up to the actual time they were caught red-handed?
Okay. Just to backtrack a second, the film itself, The Camden 28, the basic idea is... to explore how and why people, made the choice to place themselves at risk of arrest and imprisonment while protesting the war in Vietnam, and specifically, like you said, by going into draft boards, destroying documents. I don't want to say steal because the term was remove, if I'm correct, John, to remove documents from the selective service offices. The Camden 28 action happened on August 22nd, in the early morning hours of August 22nd, in Camden, New Jersey. But what's important, I think, to realize is that for the previous 4 years, there were something on the order of six dozen draft board raids across the country. Activists claimed or took responsibility for the destruction of close to a million selective service records. Now, that may sound a little high, and I kind of thought that myself, but when the Camden 28 were arrested, there were a group of supporters made that claim that up until that point there had been about a million records destroyed, and the Philadelphia Inquirer made a call down to the Selective Service office, or I should say the main headquarters in Washington, to ask them about that number. And the spokesperson there said that number was very difficult to deny. So, the government was aware that this stuff was going on. John, I don't know if you want to add anything to that. In terms of
why don't I jump in and just ask John or you, Anthony, to contextualize this under the label of Catholic left. What exactly does that label mean? In the case of the Camden 28, I believe almost everyone there was Catholic except one person.
Yeah.
I think there was one Lutheran.
That's right. There was a Lutheran minister, and there actually was one other was also not Catholic. So there were two of them. But John, since you were a member of the Catholic left, maybe you want to talk about that.
Yeah, I, trying to be brief here, traced the Catholic left back to a thing called the Catholic Worker that started in New York in 1933. And in a nutshell, a couple of folks got together way back then during the Depression and decided that we'd better start feeding, clothing, and sheltering people. And that went on for years and years and years and grew into quite a force in liberal or progressive Catholic circles. Coming out of that was a fellow named Philip Berrigan, and he was a Josephite priest who, in October 1967, along with three other people, walked into the draft boards in Baltimore, Maryland, and took the records out of that draft board. It was during the day. People were in there working. Took the records out of that draft board, outdoors, and with homemade napalm, burned the records. Oh, no, they did blood. They did blood there. Cadensville, they actually napalmed. But they poured what they said was their own blood. One of the members of the group was a nurse, so she drew blood, in a symbolic action. And they stood there and waited to be arrested. And then in May of 1968, Philip and his brother Daniel Berrigan and seven others became the Catonsville Nine. They went similarly into a draft board, middle of the day, took out records, several hundred records, outdoors. Catonsville is a suburb of Baltimore, and napalmed those with homemade napalm. And again, they were doing a symbolic action, because while we were napalming children, they were napalming the papers that allow us or make it possible for us to go and napalm villages. So it was a tremendously powerful symbolic action. Not necessarily practical in the sense that it did not shut down the draft board, but my goodness, it spoke so loudly to so many people.
And John, I was just going to say, if I could just sort of interject, and that was the point, right? To make a symbolic action.
Yes, yes. At that point.
Right, not to to shut down the draft board. And
no, we're speaking as loudly as we possibly could,
right,
and as clearly as we possibly could. And most of the people, there may have been one or two people in that action who were not Catholic, but actually it took off from there. And people have asked me, well, why was the Catholic left, so to speak, or the draft board raiders, why were they mostly Catholic? I still say because, Phil and Dan Berrigan were Catholic. You know, if it was a bunch of Lutherans that started doing it, I guess from there on in it would have been a bunch of Lutherans doing it. I don't know why. But it does come out of the Catholic worker in New York City. And it just grew. It just grew, and it was action after action after action.
Now, what year did the Camden 28 incident specifically occur? Was that 1971?
Yeah.
71.
Yeah.
71, okay.
Yeah.
All right, so, I want you to don't get too detailed, because we're going to pick this apart more
right
later on. But, mm-hmm, all right, you guys have been planning this break-in, and you guys are caught red-handed, to use the term we used earlier. What happened at the trial? The trial went on for how long? Was it 3 months?
3.5 months.
3.5 months.
It was from early February to May 20th, the jury came back.
And that was
in 73.
And the resolution of that trial was
not
all
guilty.
All people were acquitted on all counts. We were, say, facing various numbers of counts, but most of us were facing seven federal felony counts, with which we could face, I think, 47 years in prison.
You'd still
and
be there, John.
The jury came back and acquitted all of us on all counts. Some were just there on trial on conspiracy because they knew about it, they had helped, and they didn't happen to be in town that night, but they were still picked up on conspiracy.
And
we were 17 actually went to trial on various charges.
And compared to prior, similar trials, similar incidents, this one was different because it actually marked a major legal victory. Is that correct in terms of war protesters being prosecuted?
It was the first major victory.
Right.
Yeah, first and only, really. And certainly in the Catholic left. Everybody else had gone to prison. In fact, they changed the M.O. of the actions fairly early on because all of our best people were ending up in prison. And we said, gee whiz, what are we going to do here? It's very difficult to find people that are willing to sacrifice that much and take the chance on going to prison. So eventually we started doing what we call hit-and-run actions, where we go in during the night, as we did in Camden, and destroy inside or carry out as many records as we could and really try to stop that board from functioning.
So
it was no longer just a symbolic action.
So I was going to ask you about that.
Yeah.
There was that decision was made to stop these symbolic actions and actually go for something practical? I mean, because there still would be something symbolic about that action.
Oh, sure. Oh, definitely. Yeah. And there were times when we would carry things out, and since we had gotten away, we would leave a statement behind, quite well-written anti-war statements, stating that we will make our identities known as at a time and place of our own choosing. And then we would do what we called surfacing. Maybe sometimes at, you know, Rockefeller Center in New York or whatever. You know, eight people would stand up and announce that they were the ones that had knocked over the draft boards a month earlier or whatever. But the feds were powerless to do anything because they really had no proof that these were even the eight that were inside.
I should insert right now that without, you know, getting into too much detail, that the reason you guys were caught was an FBI informant. Let me just insert that really quickly, and perhaps we can talk about that a little more later on. Let me just turn the conversation over to Anthony a bit now. I want to ask you about the film itself and how you stumbled across the story and decided to make a good film. I understand you have a connection with one member of the Camden 28. There was a family connection, I think.
Yeah, well, I grew up not far from Camden, about 25 minutes north of Camden, in Edgewater Park, New Jersey. And I really, you know, have to thank a high school teacher of mine. His name is Terry Egan, because he was the one who first told me about the Camden 28. Now, Father Michael Doyle, who was a member of the Camden 28, is still a priest in Camden, New Jersey, at a parish called Sacred Heart. My parents belong to that parish. So does Terry Egan. So it was sort of the combination of my parents being at that church, where the priest who's the pastor was one of the Camden 28, and the high school teacher, former history teacher, said, oh, you know, you should talk to him about this. It's kind of a neat story. And I did with my co-conspirator, Dave Doherty. He's the videographer on the project. We went to high school together. And we'd always wanted to make a film together, and we figured this is great because this is local history. This is something that no one's ever done before. And we really thought that we could probably, since it took place in Camden, we lived around the area, we could probably do it in like a year or so. And that was in 1996, and we're editing the film right now. So that's the connection you're talking about in terms of my parents belonging to Doyle's Parish. And then us sort of connecting with him.
Let's talk a little bit about the research process, I guess the initial steps. You have, obviously, Father Doyle to go to, but how did you go about contacting where all these people were, et cetera?
Well, once I got the list of the members of the Camden 28, their names, I basically went to him and said, well, do you know where any of these people are? And he had some idea of where, not where all of them were, but a few years earlier they had a, I think, a 20-year reunion weekend just among themselves, and they had passed around a paper with all of their current addresses. So he had that, and he gave it to me. And then, you know, I started out by just writing letters and making phone calls. And I remember the first contact I had with John was a letter. And, John, I don't remember if you wrote me back first, but I do. I remember our first conversation. But was it a letter, or did I call you?
Your memory is better than mine.
Yeah. I think it was a letter. But anyway, I mean, I would say we pretty much hit it off from the beginning.
Yeah, right away.
You know, because, you know, what we did was, since they were scattered across the country, Dave Doherty and I decided to, it was the summer of 96, to drive across country. I have a brother who lives in California, two brothers anyway, so we went to go visit them. But along the way, we met with members of the Camden 28 who were spread in Pennsylvania and Chicago, South Dakota. That's right, Minnesota is south, exactly. Minnesota, South Dakota. We tried for Albuquerque, but that didn't work out. But anyway, so it was really trying to go and get the story. We didn't go out with a camera. We went out with a tape recorder just to get a handle on the story, and it was listening to them, and then we moved on to actually doing interviews. Now, I have to say that you know, there was a little bit of resistance among some of the members, because I think the fear was that that we might not be the best people to tell the story, that the story should be told by the Canaan 28 themselves, you know, that, that one of them should actually, you know, do the telling of it. But, you know, so we met a little resistance there, but since then that's been, that sort of has been taken care of. And, you know, we've interviewed a number of them. I mean, I would say probably, you know, probably 10 of them. The problem is when you're doing a film like this that involved 28 people, you can't focus on all 28 people.
Right.
You know, you need to pick a few to tell the story. So that's you know, basically what we did. And like I said before, we're editing. The film is basically half done right now. I'm working on the second part of it now.
You know, I want to ask you a question about funding, because I know these days, it's kind of a cliche, but if you actually go to your, you know, nearby cinema, you can sort of see a confirmation of this still. I know studio priorities these days are not necessarily the same as artistic priorities in terms of quality. And so I wanted to ask you about some of the, you know, have you had some problems with funding? How are you funding this?
Well, originally, back in, you know, 96, 97, 98, 99, up to 2000, Dave and I funded the film on our own. You know, we spent our own money to go across country, to rent cameras. It was really a weekend thing. Both of us had full-time jobs, other places. You know, nobody was giving us money to go out and do this film, so that's one of the reasons why it's been taking so long. So at first it was funded out of our own pockets. We applied to a number of foundations for grants, and we did get one in the amount of $2,000 from the A.J. Musty Memorial Institute, which is located down in Lafayette Street here in Manhattan. And then, you know, with that, I mean, you know, $2,000 might sound like a lot, but it's actually not. I mean, we're happy to have received that, but you know, in terms of making a film, it's sort of a drop in the bucket. So we use that, and then in May of, well, actually, I would say, well, in 2002, in January of 2002, we were contacted by the court. The court system, which is the federal courthouse in Camden, New Jersey, they have a historical society. And we were contacted by them because they were interested in doing a project where they were going to record the history of that courthouse, the famous trials that happened there. And they wanted to put on a program where we would sort of get... They actually weren't sure, but they wanted to sort of record the history of the Camden 28.
Right.
So we suggested, oh, we should do like a reunion with them. We'll bring the Camden 28 back to the courthouse. We'll see what witnesses we can get. And Howardson ended up coming as one of them. FBI agents, prosecutors, U.S. attorneys. We did this, and it was sort of a big undertaking. But we brought them together on May 4th, 2002. We did a four-hour symposium with members of the Camden 28, the FBI, so on and so forth, and we recorded that history. And the U.S. District Court of the District for the Southern District of New Jersey, they paid for that. So that was another. They paid for the actual cameras for that thing to happen.
Right.
We produced it for them, and it was sort of a trade-off. So
let me just interject here.
Yeah.
That was done in the actual courtroom where the trial took place.
Yeah.
And it was quite an event. It really was to be back in that courtroom.
And I want to
all those folks and Anthony and the other folks that are going ahead and recording this. Go ahead, Anthony.
No, it's okay.
Yeah, in just a minute, I want to ask you a bit more about the feelings that reunion elicited from some of you people after so many years.
But could I just say one more thing about
sure,
the funding?
Go ahead.
It was because of that event. I mean, it was on the front page of the Philadelphia Inquirer. It was in all of the newspapers around there. That. We really wanted to, in a sense, sort of capitalize on the popularity, the fact that everybody knew this, that we were doing this, basically take advantage of the momentum that we had there. And a month later, we had a fundraiser in Camden We had an opera singer. Her name is Barbara Dever, who was originally from Camden, actually went to Sacred Heart, was a member of Father Doyle's parish. She performed for us. Basically, she and her daughter sang. And it was a sort of a combination of her singing, and we showed parts of the film. And all of the proceeds went to the film. So there was a fundraiser right there. So that's where sort of the bulk of our money came from. So, you know, we could still use some more money.
We'll definitely, at the end of this interview, read off all the information on where people interested in this, I think, very important film can, you know, help out. Let me ask you, John, let me get your biography down. How old were you at the time this happened? What were you doing in your life, et cetera?
I think I was 27 at the time. And I was running the Catholic Peace Fellowship in Northeast D.C., right near Catholic University. I was chairman of the Catholic Peace Fellowship. And that had also come out of the Catholic Worker. That was started by Jim Forrest and Tom Cornell. And there was just so many things going on in those days, you know. And they had branches all over the country, and I just happened to be heading up one branch in one town. But it happened to be D.C., so there was a lot of activity. And I met Phil Berrigan after an action in D.C. by the DC-9. And that would have been in March of 1969. And Phil, always being a recruiter, I introduced myself to him because we had a lot of friends in common. And always being a recruiter, he said, well, you know, when are you going to get involved in something like this? You know, referring to the DC-9. And because we had met at a headquarters for the DC-9. And he just planted some ideas in my head, and I got to know him pretty well. And, you know, the rest is history, as they say. I just got involved in it, and Camden was certainly not the first action I did. It was the last.
Yeah. You know...
Oh, go ahead.
Well, you know, what... I guess the question is I mean, it was Phil Berrigan then. I mean, he was the big influence on you.
Yes.
Okay.
Definitely.
And, and I mean, you're free to talk about previous actions if you want. You don't have to if you don't want.
I would not necessarily name places.
Yeah, but you were.
We can talk about it in general if you want.
Sure, but you were involved in other ones. But as far as Camden was concerned, I mean, you didn't even know that the action was being planned, did you?
No, not at first.
So maybe
there's so many things going on, and I was happened to be in D.C. and I was involved in the Harrisburg trial at the time. That big trial took place in Harrisburg with Phil and Dan and a bunch of other people. I don't know if you remember it or reading about it, but they were charged with a conspiracy to kidnap Henry Kissinger and blow up heating tunnels in D.C. And it became a huge trial. And I was named an unindicted co-conspirator in that trial. So I was kind of tied up with that, if my timeline is correct. Yeah, because that indictment came down in January of 71, I think. I'm going from memory here. And so I was involved in that. And then I was called to Camden because they needed some help. And so they kind of... Paul Cooming, bless his heart, called me and said, hey, we need some help up here. Can you come? And I said, yeah, sure. And that's a lot of times how people got involved in these things.
Let me ask you, how many months of preparation prior to the actual date of the raid itself, how many months of preparation were there?
Well, in this particular action, Anthony, you remember when they first got together out there?
Yeah, well, I mean, if you remember, it started with Trenton, that they were planning to do the board in Trenton, and then for various reasons that sort of fell apart, and another group ended up doing Trenton. It was in the spring of 71 that Trenton ended up happening. And then they basically came down to Camden. So it happens in August. They're planning in June. They're planning in May. You know, probably like in April, I would say. They really sort of started their surveillance of the building. And you know, if you think about it, it's really, I mean, this isn't like, you don't just say, okay, the draft board is in Camden, downtown Camden, so next Tuesday night, let's go in and take records. I mean, it's not that simple, is it, John?
No. In fact, a rule of thumb, I guess, just generally speaking, it would take months of surveillance, and we would really watch a building, let's say, from several different angles, because you want to get a sense of what the social system is around that building. Now, this is going to sound very, I don't know, criminal, for lack of a better word, you know, to listeners. But we do it for a few reasons. One, obviously, is you want to get in and out of the building without being stopped. You also don't want to hurt anybody on the way in or out. You don't want to get hurt yourself on the way in or out. So we really watch a building all the way around from different angles because you want to know if, let's say, at 3 a.m. every other Tuesday somebody stops by that building. That's good information to know because then you don't pick that time. And you really look for a window of opportunity. If there's a guard in that building and he's near the front door, you don't want to go in the front door. Again, you don't want to get stopped, but you also don't want, most of these guards are just, you know, it's probably a part-time job for them. They're older guys. You know, you don't want some guy getting a heart attack or whatever. We have actually dumped, or let's say just scrapped a few possible actions because there were guards in the building. There were roving people. We did not want a physical confrontation. We were nonviolent. We did not see it as violence to destroy paper that was used to destroy lives. But we certainly did not want a physical confrontation. But it would take months to kind of watch closely and come up with that window of opportunity and say, okay, Saturday night or Wednesday evening, you know, that type of thing is it, and then go.
And there's just something else, you know, like thinking about this. I mean, really not to romanticize it at all, but I mean, it sounds like it could also be fun in a sense, right? I mean, wouldn't you say in terms of, you know, hiding out and kind of looking and, you know, waiting and, like, I think you described that as a game sometimes.
Fun.
You know what I mean.
You know,
by
there
fun.
Is a rush to it, though. There is.
Well, I mean, you know what I mean. I mean, it's.
And it's us against them, and we're getting over on them. I mean, that aspect is definitely there. I'm not going to deny it. But what we're also getting over on is the war machine. You know,
right.
We're beating them.
Right.
They're the big powers that be. They have the FBI, they have the Justice Department, they have the Pentagon, and here's a bunch of Catholic lefties going in there and ripping them off and getting away with it.
Let me ask you about how you guys all met. You know, there were months of preparation, but how did you guys first meet, or, you know, was it, you know, is that an accurate characterization of it, or did people just sort of flow in and out in the preceding months, or did you all sort of have some sort of basis on which to come together at the very start? I mean, where did you guys meet each other?
Well, for this action, I already knew a lot of people because I'd been in previous actions. So, you know, when I arrived up there, it was like almost old home week. But there were a lot of new people I had not met before that were, some were local people that had been drawn in. They had, I don't know, you meet people through people, you know. Gene and Mike and a few others were trying to get something going in Camden. They drew in some of their friends, you know, that type of thing. Milo Billman was the Lutheran minister there. You know, he knew somebody who knew somebody. You know, it was that type of thing. But I'd say for fully half of us, we knew one another before we ever arrived at Camden. And that was just, I met people in that way I described the new people meeting one another. I had just done it a year before. You know, you walk into a room and there's three people you know and five people you don't know, and you begin to pull an action together.
How frequently did you guys meet for preparations, and would you describe it as more informal, or you know, were you very rigid about planning things out and staking out the joint and things like that?
Well, in generally, again, because I was only in the Camden scene for about a week before the action. You know, other actions, I was there from the very beginning. But generally the way it worked is you'd start with a meeting in someone's home or whatever, and Phil might be there, Dan, a few other people, and trying to pull another action together. And it was very clear why people were there. And, you know, one of the first things we talked about, and this was very informal, is, you know, why are you here? What are you doing here? What do you want to do? And we would progress you know, can you go to prison? Are you ready for prison? Prison was always a distinct possibility, and you went into it knowing that if you're not picked up this time, you'd be picked up some other time, but you better be ready for prison because this is what you opted for. And you kind of weed out some people that just are not ready, or they would weed themselves out and say, no, I'm not ready for this. But you would slowly pull a group together, and then you would pick a place to hit and begin to case it. At the beginning, not that often, you know, maybe a few nights a week or whatever, but as you got closer and closer, it was every night, almost round the clock, and we were living on site. We were living in the town, in the city in which we were going to do the action. Most of us were from outside the area.
Was there something particular about Camden that you know, made you guys decide that would be the next target? I mean, why Camden?
Anthony can speak to that better than
well,
I can. He knows the actual history of this thing better than I do.
I mean, I would say, first of all, because it started with Trenton.
Right.
You know, and the people who... Basically, there was a core group of people in Camden who were from Camden. Like Mike Giacondo was from Camden, Gene Dixon was from Camden, Michael Doyle was from Camden, Milo Billman was from Camden. You know, they start, like John was saying, get to talking. You know, we want to do something here. There had been previous draft board raids. What can we do here? And somehow, through this friend of a friend type of thing, they find out that there's something going on in Trenton, and they're invited to help up in Trenton. So they help Case in Trenton. Like I said before, Trenton falls through, and everything gets focused in on Camden. So there's that reason. There's the reason that, you know, people there wanted to do something. There's a draft board in Camden. The other reason is that, and Father Doyle sort of speaks really well to this, is the city itself. I mean, it's a terribly poor city today. In fact, in a lot of ways, it's worse today than it was in 1971. But these people had the sense that, you know, the money that's being spent on this war in Vietnam could be better spent at home building buildings here in Camden, you know, rebuilding Camden, helping out the people in Camden. So there was a way to make that type of a statement, you know, in Camden. I mean, Doyle says Camden was the perfect place because of that. In fact, I'll just tell quickly, you know, one of his, he says the reason that he was asked to sort of get involved in the Trenton thing was because he was at a meeting with a bunch of, priests, the lay people, and they were trying to talk about what can we do, you know, about the war, but in terms of, you know, what the church itself, what type of a statement can the church make? And someone had suggested, oh, well, we should pick one day on a Sunday and we should all, you know, preach about war. And he sort of stood up and said, you know what, a better idea would be to get, you know, get bricks from broken down buildings in Camden, get a list of everybody who died in Vietnam in Camden, you know, wrap that piece of paper around the bricks and throw it through every window of a military installation in South Jersey, and that's your statement. And someone there then, I think, told John Grady or somebody that, hey, there's this, you know, this priest, you know, who might be interested in this kind of stuff.
Right.
And
there's,
you know,
a brick thrower in Camden.
What's that?
There's this brick thrower
exactly.
in Camden.
So you know, that they made that connection between the waste in Vietnam, the waste of the monies in Vietnam, and the deteriorating conditions in Camden, and said, well, this is a good statement to make here.
I think this is a good time for me to talk about one aspect of your film that I like a lot, which is you intersperse and contextualize the Camden episode with a shots of Camden today, and also a Vietnam documentary footage of the actual military operations in Vietnam. I wanted to ask John, what sort of effect seeing these on television or reading accounts, in increasingly critical accounts in newspaper, even in mainstream newspapers, what kind of effect did that have on you and your motivation to do something like this, and your the development of your political consciousness?
Well, actually, I was in the Navy from 64 to 68. I joined the Navy right after the Tonkin Gulf Resolution. And when I went in, nobody even knew what Vietnam was. We did not know. We in the active duty military did not know what Vietnam was. There were some things on bulletin boards in the barracks, and you kind of look at them and say, oh, well, you know, what's going on over there? What's that all about? By the time I got out in 68, it was the biggest issue in the country. LBJ had already admitted that he cannot run for re-election. I mean, it was just huge. We were thinking 1968. I got out in August of 68. So while I was in, I became more and more aware of what was going on there. And I actually supported the war the first 2 years I was in. And the last 2 years I was in, I did not. But, of course, I did not want to desert or anything. I did my 2 years and got out. And immediately, instantly, within a month, got in touch with the anti-war movement. I don't remember exactly how. But it was actually Catholics. And, you know, it just dragged on and on and on. And actually, let's see, I got out in 68, March 69, like I said, was the DC-9 action. And that's where I really ran into people who were really doing something. Before then, I was just kind of doing paperwork at Catholic Peace Fellowship, we were doing draft counseling and things like that, and helping fellows get their conscientious objector status and not go to that war. But I really wanted something more hands-on. I mean, the thing was dragging on. It was on television every night, and there was this huge anti-war movement swelling up, getting larger and larger. It was just all around us. I mean, people listening today who were not living at that time cannot imagine how huge this issue was. It permeated our entire lives. It was a lead story on every newscast, every night, for years. It was in every paper, front page, and it was just getting worse and worse and worse. And the songwriters and everybody, you know, it was just, you tuned into Sunday night TV, and there it was, you know, the Smothers Brothers or whoever, you know, singing Waist Deep in the Big Muddy or whoever was doing that, you know. And it just totally surrounded us. You couldn't get away from it. Could not get away from it.
Do you-